It is not hard to destroy a college.
Last season, the podcast Campus Files brought you stories of fraternity drug rings, stolen body parts, campus cults, and more.
And now Campus Files is back for another season.
There's a guy screaming into his phone. He's like, I just saw Charlie Kirk get assassinated right in front of me.
Every week is a new episode and a new story.
It was so chaotic.
It's almost like a university under siege.
Listen to and follow Campus Files, available now wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a true crime roundup from the On Deadline podcast. We dive into crime stories reported on by Odyssey radio newsrooms across the country. I'm your host, Lauren Berry. This week, we'll hear about one journalist's investigation into a century-old murder case that still haunts her hometown. Then, we'll hear about a befuddling manhunt conducted in Kansas City, after the dead body of the man authorities were looking for was sniffed out by cadaver dogs. And finally, we'll touch on a case that reveals the new crime-solving possibilities that DNA analysis has opened up. And we'll break down the newest revelations in the Nancy Guthrie missing persons case. First, we're going to check in on quick crime updates from coast to coast, including a case linked to a cult-like group of computer scientists, and the mistrial of a man accused of causing a massive wildfire in California last year. We'll start with a harrowing case out of Odyssey Station 1010 Winds in New York, reporting on Tuesday, June 23rd.
Three women in Bayport, a woman, her mother, and her daughter in court, indicted on charges of torturing a 7-year-old girl to death. And the cries heard in the courtroom eventually spilled into the hallway, where family and friends struggled to come to grips with how this happened. And then those cries turned to anger, which led to a big fight right outside the courthouse. 1010 Winds reporter Sophia Hall leading us off with cries for Jordan.
I can't believe that anybody in their right mind would do something like that.
Family and friends of 7-year-old Jordan Duncan cried as they packed the courtroom. In fact, there were so many supporters, some had to remain outside in the hallway.
Heartbreaking, monstrous.
They screamed as they left, saying they do not understand how three generations of women could be accused of torturing the little girl in their custody until she died.
To miss that many days of school and no one calls CPS.
And outside the courthouse, the supporters, most wearing Jordan's favorite color pink, began fighting.
What happened out here was something stupid.
No one was injured. Sophia Hall, 1010 Winds on 92.3 FM on Long Island.
Yeah, court officials came outside and broke up the fight. It's unclear who started it. Meantime, we'll continue to monitor developments in this case and let you know the outcome. All three women pleaded not guilty today in court.
In Philadelphia, Odyssey station KYW News Radio also reported on a disturbing case involving family on Tuesday.
A community is reeling after Philadelphia police say a grandmother killed her granddaughter and her own sister and then shot herself yesterday afternoon. KYW's crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson has more.
Officials say Janice Picano shot her 18-year-old granddaughter who had autism and then her own 55-year-old sister, Denise Gratini, inside a home along 10th Street near Oregon, not far from the stadiums. Picano was her granddaughter's primary caregiver.
You just don't hear about things like that in this neighborhood. You know, it's just a very quiet, nice neighborhood. And I've been here 30 years. That's a shame.
Sources say the 67-year-old woman was in severe distress and called 911 to tell police what she had done before turning the gun on herself. It happened around 5:30 in the evening. They say her husband came home to find the three dead inside. Police arrived soon after to sort out what happened. Detectives are still investigating. Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
And here are two more Tuesday dispatches from KYW.
A man was shot and critically wounded outside a corner store in West Philadelphia. It was around 2 a.m. near 61st and Vine, where the guy was inside the store playing a gambling machine. He walks out. Someone gets out of a minivan and walks up to him.
At which point our victim drew his firearm, had some exchange of words with the suspect. The suspect then drew his firearm. And two shots were fired, striking the victim in the stomach.
Police Captain Timothy Steffen, he says the shooter got back in the van, drove off. At the scene, investigators found a mountain bike and a handgun they say belongs to the victim. They say he did not have a permit to carry.
A man was shot in the face in East Germantown, then tried to drive himself to the hospital. Happened just after midnight near Germantown Ave in Church Lane. The guy was sitting in a caddy with his girlfriend when someone walked up and fired 14 shots at the car. The man was hit in the cheek, but Captain Timothy Steffen says somehow they missed the girl.
Unknown how she didn't get hit. Obviously, she was the passenger of the car with 14 rounds going into the car. Only luckily, by the grace of God, that the driver was the only person struck inside that vehicle.
The man tried to drive himself to the hospital, got about five blocks down Germantown Ave, where he waved down an officer who was directing traffic. The officer took him to the hospital in his patrol car. The shooter, seen running into an alleyway, police are checking surveillance video to try to identify him.
On Wednesday, the station reported on this case involving alleged murder and fire.
A 38-year-old woman has been charged with murder, accused of setting a fire that killed a man and displaced a dozen others Monday afternoon in North Philadelphia. KYW's crime and justice reporter Kristen Johansson has the details.
Natasha Teague faces murder, arson, and a dozen counts of both risking and causing catastrophe and reckless endangerment charges in Monday's fire that killed a 69-year-old man and damaged six homes. Deputy Police Commissioner Frank Van Noor says it started over an argument.
She was living there. Also, one of the witnesses was living there, and she was occupying the house in the recent, and I think this argument involved her leaving, and she didn't want to leave that residence.
He says Teague tried to start another fire earlier in the morning, and then again around 1 in the afternoon, she succeeded. Venora says the home, located on Percy Street right off of Rising Sun Avenue near Erie Avenue, went up quickly, and people in the neighboring homes were trapped. But firefighters were able to put it out and pull everyone to safety except Barry Turner, who was pronounced dead at the scene.
The fire definitely spread, which is always dangerous when we're talking about row homes. It quickly could spread, so very dangerous situation.
Teague has a lengthy criminal record in other states, including drugs, burglary, retail theft, criminal trespassing, forgery, hindering apprehension, and a gun charge. Now she faces murder. Kristen Johansson, KYW News Radio, 103.9 FM.
According to reporting from the Associated Press, a cult-like group called the Zizians has been linked to multiple murders across the United States. A 2025 report from the AP said that the group's goals were unclear, but that their writing spanned topics from radical veganism and gender identity to artificial intelligence. Now, another case has been linked to the Zizians. KYW reported on it this Wednesday.
Authorities in Delaware County have charged a woman connected to a cult-like group with the 2022 New Year's Eve murder of her parents. KYW's Matt Coughlin joins us now live from Delaware County.
The district attorney's office here in Delaware County says 33-year-old Michelle Zajko is charged with the murder on New Year's Eve of her parents, Richard and Rita. Zajko is a member, reportedly, of the Zizians, a cult-like group of computer scientists that have been connected to murders in California, Vermont, and now Delaware County. As authorities announced the arrest this afternoon, Roseanne Zajko, Michelle's aunt and Richard's sister, spoke to the media.
We don't know yet if the trial will begin to heal the void in our lives and the ache in our hearts, but we do know that the detectives, the DA's office, and we, the family, have done everything possible to achieve justice for Rita and Rick.
The district attorney, Tanner Roos, he says investigators pieced together evidence, including ring camera audio of someone saying mom outside the Zajko home shortly before the murder. Police discovered shell casings recovered at the crime scene. They were later able to match those shell casings to shell casings found at Michelle Zajko's home in Vermont, where she lived at the time. And they also have messages between Zajko and others where Zajko discusses the mistakes she believes she made. This is according to police, of course, mistakes that she says she made when her parents were killed. Roos says it's unclear, Raquel, when the murder case will move forward. Zajko is facing charges in Western Maryland of trespassing and firearms.
All right, Matt, thank you. That's KYW's Matt Coughlin joining us live from Delaware County.
In another report this week, KYW provided an update to a murder case linked to Temple University.
History That Doesn't Suck is a legit, hard-hitting American history podcast told through entertaining stories. Join me, Professor Greg Jackson, for History That Doesn't Suck, an Odyssey podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
A Philadelphia man accused of killing a Temple University student 2 years ago has been sentenced to 15 to 40 years in prison. Tymir Lackey pleaded guilty in March to third-degree murder in the killing of Milan Jones, who was about to enter his third year of college. The murder happened in 2024, a few blocks south from Temple's campus. Jones was found unresponsive with blunt force trauma to the head, and Lackey was arrested on scene. He was a student as well, but had been suspended from campus.
In the Midwest, the victim of a decades-old case has finally been identified. Here's Odyssey station WBBM News Radio in Chicago with the news this week.
In 1975, Clinton, Iowa sheriff's deputies responded to a report and found a dead teenager in the Mississippi River, but she could not be identified. After an autopsy, the death was ruled a homicide. The Clinton Sheriff's Office now says Cheryl Lynn Edwards of Waukegan was positively identified through forensic genealogy. Iowa officials say the new technology means the homicide investigation can proceed. Edwards' family has been notified. Roger Plummer, News Radio, 105.9 WBBM.
WBBM also reported on an interesting development in the Starved Rock killer case this week.
Attorneys for Chester Uyghur are asking Governor Pritzker to grant a posthumous pardon nearly a year after the convicted Starved Rock killer died at the age of 86. Uyghur confessed to the 1960 killings of three women at Starved Rock State Park, but was only convicted in one of those murders. He later claimed the confession was coerced and maintained his innocence for decades. His attorney now argues the killings were part of a murder-for-hire plot and has filed a petition with the Illinois Prisoner Review Board seeking to clear Uyghur's name. Rachel Pearson, News Radio, 105.9 WBBM.
In Minnesota, there's been a date set for the sentencing of a man convicted of attacking multiple Democratic lawmakers. Odyssey station WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities reported.
The federal judge presiding over Vance Belter's murder case will sentence him later this summer. Court documents show Belter is scheduled to appear before Judge John Thunheim at the federal courthouse in Minneapolis on July 23rd at 10 a.m. Earlier this month, Belter pleaded guilty to shooting and killing Minnesota House Speaker Emerita Melissa Hortman and her husband Mark, and critically injuring State Senator John Hoffman and his wife Yvette.
The trial for a 30-year-old man accused of setting a blaze that eventually grew into a massive wildfire in the Los Angeles area last year ended in a mistrial this week. Odyssey station KNX News in Los Angeles had the details.
A defeat, a major defeat for the government. That's how the attorney for Jonathan Rinderknecht described this mistrial in the arson case against the defendant. He'd been accused of starting the Lockman fire New Year's Day 2025, a week later after smoldering underground. It's believed to have sparked the Palisades fire disaster. Jurors told the judge they were deadlocked. Deadlocked 10, not guilty. Just 2 convinced the defendant was guilty. Here's one of the not guilty jurors.
We couldn't come to an agreement. It just wasn't happening.
What led you to the not guilty conclusion?
There's just not enough proof. It was just happened so late in time, and I just felt like
a lot of holes.
Yeah, a lot of holes.
The prosecution did lack any evidence of a person or security video, something that actually showed the defendant starting the fire. The judge did declare the mistrial, and on social media, the U.S. Attorney's Office vowed practically before the courtroom was empty that there would be a retrial. The defendant's attorney says this case has become highly political.
He was encouraged that the jury heard the evidence for 2.5 weeks, and pretty resoundingly found that the government's case was not strong and they didn't have enough evidence to convict him. So obviously an acquittal would have been preferred, but a hung jury on a 10-2 verdict, to be frank, in most districts, you're not going to have a retrial, but you will in this district.
Why is that?
Well, he tweeted out, apparently, Bill Asaley, while we were in the courtroom, he tweeted out that he was going to retry the case. So that tells you kind of what's going on with what they do in this district in terms of making charging decisions. I believe the evidence was overwhelming at trial, and the jury did too, that there was not enough evidence to convict Jonathan.
For a time, the judge was contemplating freeing the defendant ahead of his retrial. Eventually, she decided against it, the retrial, Brian. It's now set for October 19th.
Attorney Rachel Fizay joined KNX News' Margaret Carrero to further discuss what's going on with this case.
Did it surprise you that the judge declared this mistrial so early after something like 13 hours of deliberations?
It really did not. And that has a lot to do with the emotional plea that the prosecution made throughout. So I believe the judge really did not truly in her heart perhaps believe that this should be a prosecution verdict. And she also probably believed that people were really digging in their heels and that more deliberation would be fruitless.
You know, one juror was speaking to reporters after this all went down this morning and said that a majority during their deliberations was always not guilty. As we heard from our Craig Figner at the very end, it was 10 jurors in favor of acquittal. What do you make of that? And why were they leaning toward not guilty?
The evidence in this case was scant and all circumstantial. And by circumstantial, I mean there was literally not a piece of direct evidence that would tie RenderConnect to actually starting this fire that burned 7 days later to cause this devastation. And I think that was fairly glaringly obvious throughout this prosecution. At the same time, people wanted someone to blame. There were emotional pleas. There was circumstantial evidence that perhaps this defendant's state of mind might have been such that he would start a fire. So I think you really had polarizing testimony from both sides, and the arguments from both sides were really just playing into very specific but different parts of people's emotions.
The mistrial was declared. It wasn't very long after that the first assistant U.S. attorney, Bill Esaley, took to X and announced that his office will retry the case. Is that typical when the vast majority of jurors want to acquit, or do prosecutors just normally just accept defeat?
Well, often prosecutors will say they're going to retry a case after a mistrial, but it doesn't happen. If I am the U.S. attorney at this point, I am going back to the drawing board. I am wondering what has to be done differently in order to get a win. And that includes changing the charges if that's what needs to be done. And I also believe they would be re-entering plea negotiations, because right now the defense has the upper hand and all they have to do is come back and basically put on the exact same case to either get a defense verdict or another mistrial.
When it comes to retrials, are they generally successful?
Retrials can be successful. It does happen for sure. But what happens is new evidence. Like, there has to be something done differently. So at this point, they have to find new evidence. They reopen the investigation and they look for that smoking gun, if you will, something that will convince a jury that he is guilty.
I'm Anna Garcia, host of True Crime News, the podcast. Every week, we bring you in-depth coverage on cases making headlines, as well as those that go under the radar. Tune in for Murders That Defy Explanation, Mystery Seeking Exploration, and Shocking Secrets That Will Leave You Breathless. Each week, we honor the victims by going beyond the salacious in our search for justice. Crime never stops, and neither do we. Listen to True Crime News, available now on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now we're diving into a vintage crime case. Annie McCormick is a former TV broadcaster and a longtime Philadelphia journalist. When she found out about a murder in her beloved hometown of Moorestown, New Jersey, McCormick soon found herself investigating the century-old crime. It's a story that starts in a Moorestown mansion, where Ruth Wilson and her former fiancé, Horace Reds Roberts, both just 24 years old, were discovered barely alive after suffering gunshot wounds to the head. While detectives at the time thought that Reds might be the culprit, his own wounds pushed away easy explanations. What followed was an investigation with many twists and turns that eventually drew the attention of an investigator dubbed America's Sherlock Holmes, and mysteries around it linger to this day. McCormick joined KYW's Christian Johansson this week to discuss her new book on the case. It's called Restless Ghosts: Murder, Suicide, and the Case That Wouldn't Stay Buried.
So tell me a little bit about the crime.
So there's two crimes in the book. The first crime is 1929. There's two socialites that are found shot and dying in a mansion in Morristown. They are a couple that had been off and on. They had been engaged. They broke up. They were engaged again and they broke up. So that was ruled a murder-suicide. And the theory was that Ruth Wilson, who was one of the victims, had again denied advances from her longtime off and on again fiance boyfriend, who is Horace Reds Roberts. So they determine right away without an autopsy that it is a murder-suicide. The problem is once there was pressure put on them by local police and also the media to look further into the murder-suicide, because immediately they determined that he was shot at least three times in the head, they then had to have what they called back then a coroner's inquest. And in a coroner's inquest, you basically get a small jury. It's almost similar to what a grand jury would be today. But they had to get a jury, and then they had to dig up the bodies because they had never initially performed an autopsy. And so then they had to perform the autopsies. And when they performed the autopsy, they found that he wasn't shot three times in the head. He was shot four times in the head. But the verdict of the coroner's inquest was, again, a murder-suicide. And at the time, you know, people are still scratching their heads. How can you say this? But then it just went away. Everyone said, okay, you know, due process was done. Let's move on. Well, in 1933, their friend from growing up and also Reds's college roommate is found murdered in a house in Cinnaminson where he had moved from Morristown to Cinnaminson, where he lived with his wife and his young daughter. But he too was a Morristown socialite and had grown up catty corner from Ruth Wilson in another Morristown mansion. So immediately everybody starts to say, wait a minute, this has to be connected. And prior to his death, Bradway Brown, who's the victim in 1933, he started telling people. People were saying that he said, I believe that there was a double murder. I believe that Horace Reds Roberts and Ruth Wilson were murdered. There was all these rumors surrounding that where he was looking into it and saying that. So immediately everybody's like, oh my God, these have to be connected. So the 1933 murder investigation is happening, but at the same time, it's reopening the 1929 investigation. And it's the same investigator tasked with both investigations, and he's famous. He already was famous. He was called America's Sherlock Holmes. His name is Ellis Parker, and he was the chief detective of the Burlington County Prosecutor's Office. He had actually been tapped by the FBI at some points to solve other crimes in America. That's how famous he was. It was a big deal to him because he felt, I have to prove the murder-suicide was the murder-suicide, and I got to solve this other crime. In the end, he feels vindicated with the decisions that are made, and then he falls in infamy because of the Lindbergh baby case, which is another twist that comes in between both of the crimes, between 1929 and 1933, because the Lindbergh baby kidnapping happened in 1932.
Why did you pick this case?
So I grew up in Morristown, and I love my hometown, and I thought I knew so much about Morristown's extensive history. So when I read an article in the New York Daily News in 2021, I think my brother sent it to me, I thought, how did I never hear about this? And I know all these locations, and the locations are still there today. They're in pristine condition. All of the houses, the original Morristown Town Hall where the coroner's inquest was held, the mortuary, the graveyards, everything is still there. So when I started reading about it, and I'm in Morristown often, I couldn't help but constantly look around and think, wow, like this happened there and this happened there. And the more I read about it, which I had to do all through really old newspapers, the more newspapers I found, not expecting to find new angles, I kept finding new twists to the case. There's even more twists and turns than just what I explain in a synopsis. And there's already twists and turns in the synopsis. So it's like I fell down this rabbit hole. And each newspaper and each year that I'm still reading more information about the two different cases and the impact on the community and the town and how the town basically is wondering if the justice system even works, I needed to know the answer. I needed to know the conclusion. And at the same time, I'm covering modern day cases that are reflecting what happened almost 100 years ago. And you'd think by now you wouldn't have cases like that you wouldn't have doubt in cases today with all the advances we have in technology compared to cases 100 years ago, but you do. And so some of the cases I was covering, like the Ellen Greenberg case and, you know, other cases where there's just a ton of doubt surrounding it, it made me even more interested in how do you get doubt, right? What causes the doubt in a case to make it be reopened? How does that happen in cases? And so that's why I really wanted to read Soup to Nuts, everything about both of these crimes. It's nonfiction, so you can't make up your own ending. But towards the end of it, I think the reader is left with a lot of questions, and I want the reader to come to their own conclusion. I don't ever, as a journalist, want to tell people what I think or where my head's at, because to be honest with you, I go back and forth. I vacillate on a lot of these verdicts and you know, and the cases that we cover in modern day and even this one, because when you hear new evidence or when you hear a new angle that comes through, you have to stop, take a step back and think, how does this impact this case that I'm reporting on? I mean, I think that that's the responsible thing to do. So even with this case, you know, I think, okay, all of the elements of him committing a murder-suicide are there. It's unrequited love, the weapon they were able to identify that he actually had that type of gun. But again, he shot four times in the head. How can you shoot yourself four times in the head? It's interesting too what the theories from investigators are for him to do that. They actually refer to the gun as a toy gun, and it's not. It's an actual gun.
There's so much detail in it too. Where do you pull that some of it? It's just so detailed. You describe the blood on the dad. Can you explain a little bit of like how much research goes into this?
And that's the part, it's the detail that takes the longest, because you want to make sure that you're gathering enough research that you have all the angles. So I relied most heavily on newspaper archives. And what was great back then is there was so much space in newspapers. So you had, reporters had more space that they could use. And the coroner's inquest was actually printed in full in the newspaper. So I have firsthand accounts of all of the people that were involved, and it's an court proceeding. So that was tremendously helpful, because I have from the major players what they did that night, where they were, what actions they took, what actions they didn't take. That was very, very helpful. And then I have all the different perspectives of the newspaper reporting. And what's interesting is in 1929, it got a lot of press coverage from our local newspapers. And there was a New York Times or New York Daily News article here and there. But in 1933, when the Bradway Brown killing happened and the 1929 cases reopened, well, it was at a different time period where a lot of, you know, detective magazines were big. And I guess at that time, the newspapers were really, tabloids were really big, and the detective books were really big. So there was more coverage of both cases. So I found out even more about the 1929 case in 1933, just based on more reporting. The New York Daily News reported on it extensively. The New York Times reported on it extensively. And in fact, it was never mentioned in 1929 that Bradway Brown and Ruth Wilson at one time had dated, but the New York Times started reporting that in 1933. And so there was a lot that I was able to take from the 1933 reporting that I had never seen in 1929. Now, when it came to when I'm describing the weddings, when I'm describing a lot of their social life and the socialite activity, all of that was printed in the newspapers back then. You know, they didn't have social media. They didn't have Facebook. They had some pictures, but obviously they're not color pictures, but they describe the wedding party's dresses and their outfits in such detail, because that was really important then. It was a big deal for somebody's socialite wedding to be printed in the newspaper. And they also would print who's having dinner with who. And it would be all the prominent people, you know, who's, you know, the Wilsons are having dinner with this judge on Friday evening at their home. Like, who would ever write that today? But back then, they thought that was important. Where are you going to summer? Well, the Wilsons will be summering in Florida in February, which is actually stupid, because then people would go like rob their houses. I think because back then the media landscape was different. You relied so heavily on the newspapers. The only other medium was really radio. And maybe when you go to a movie, at the motion picture at the end of it or beginning of it, they have newsreels, but the newsreels were national. So the media landscape was so different back then. and newspapers dominated it, that's really how to get the bulk of my reporting. I also went to the New Jersey State Archives to try to get court records. And what's interesting is in the New Jersey State Archives, they do have court records from the 1934 trial for the 1933 murder, but they don't have anything for the coroner's inquest. And I don't know if it's at that time, they just didn't have that on the record, or was something that they just didn't keep in their files. Sometimes I would run into walls where I would be getting somewhere and then I couldn't get the answers if the newspaper was just done reporting on it. That's kind of where the end of the road was. But there's also a couple books. Ellis Parker had a couple books written about him. One was one of these detective books. That was a big thing back then, the detective magazines, the detective books, and where he regales on all of his big cases that he's covered. And in this one book about him, he goes in detail about Bradway Brown's murder. And that's how I was able to recreate when he arrived to the crime scene and his responses and who else was there and the conversations they were having versus what the media was reporting on. So I was able to have Ellis Parker's firsthand accounts from that in addition to what he said in the inquest. And so, yeah, so that's what I relied on. Cool. So a lot of that, but it was a lot of reading. In fact, there's 7 pages of endnotes, which is, that's a lot, because these are real people. It's 100 years ago, but they're real people. They still have family members. I want to be fair to everybody. I don't want them misquoted. And the newspapers are so old that some of them that were scanned, you can't see completely. So I actually had them sent to a transcription service that transcribed them into Word documents to make sure that I wouldn't misquote anyone. It was really important to me to make sure that everything was right and true and accurate, just like I would report on a modern day crime.
Are there still family members of these people that are around that you maybe spoke to?
So they're Bradway Brown's granddaughter is still alive. His daughter just passed away a year ago. Lovely family, didn't really want to be involved, but, you know, told me a few things about their family, and they're great. And I just wanted to loop them in because I didn't want any surprises. And just like I would in a modern day crime, I wanted to be respectful to the victims and to their families.
Highway shootings in Kansas City this month led to a manhunt for the suspect, 22-year-old Oscar Sanchez Munoz. But there was something strange about this manhunt. Authorities had apparently already found the suspect, and he was dead. Here's the Dana and Parks show out of Odyssey Station KMBZ in Kansas City, reporting on the news this week.
So we brought to you the breaking news update that the manhunt for Oscar Sanchez Munoz, who has been on the run for 8 days since he drove down I-670 and I-70, firing his gun at multiple vehicles. He was also tied to a June 11th shooting. They have found a body in the basement of the first home.
Of the burned out home?
Yes. So we thought that it was maybe a different home. We had no idea. The KSHB story was not clear, but this is now clear that it was the same house.
Listen to Channel 9. Kansas City police say family members found a deceased person inside the burned Independence home connected to the investigation. Sergeant Jake Bikina, spokesman for the Kansas City Police Department, said detectives are working under the assumption the body is that of 22-year-old Oscar Sanchez Munoz. They are awaiting confirmation from the medical examiner's office. He agreed the discovery of the body after multiple searches of the home is, quote, unusual. But police say the basement was inaccessible for a period of time, full of water and extremely congested with items and furniture.
If you're confused, you're not alone. Dana Wright and Sam Stevie tried to work out some of the facts around the case timeline here.
Help me with the timeline here.
Okay.
Oh my God. The shooting happened on what date?
It was the evening of June 16th as fans were driving into World Cup.
And one of those shot was an Uber driver. Yep. One of those shot was killed. Homicidal maniac then goes on the run. What was the date of he goes to his brother's house and goes Joe Walsh?
They followed him to the brother's house that evening. That Operation 100 lasted into the late hours of the morning.
Into June 17th.
That's correct.
Okay.
At some point in the early morning hours, the house was set on fire. It's not clear if he set it on fire. It was a blaze.
I just want to be clear.
They then took hours to put the fire out.
Mass shooting was June 16th.
Yes.
The standoff, he got away, we can't find him, fire was June 17th.
The second standoff that they thought was a standoff at the Kensington Avenue property was the following day.
Okay.
The picture, by the way, from the convenience store was from June 16th.
Right, but here's why I'm asking this, and I think our listeners, if you're following along, he committed this crime on the 16th, fires on the 17th. So are you telling me that this entire manhunt and the second Operation 100 was absolutely for naught?
Yes.
Because he was dead the entire time.
In the basement.
In the original crime scene where the fire happened.
It didn't really make a whole lot of sense to me that they were seemingly telling us that he was definitely in the home, in the brother's home, or his home, we're not sure. The one on Brookside Boulevard in Independence.
There's no way they thought that there was a body in the house. They never would have released that house back to family members for the family members to find a body.
According to the reporting, they were initially certain that he was in that home, right? And then he just somehow got out. How do you just somehow get out, right?
Well, I think maybe he set the house on fire and ran in a cloak of smoke. But Sam, look, there's been a lot of resources put toward this thing.
Yeah.
If he was dead the entire time in the initial crime scene in Independence.
In the basement, covered in water and debris and...
No, we have death-sniffing dogs that could have gone through that house, do we not?
I'm not so sure that a dog would be able to really accurately sniff out a body among so much soot and fire and I mean, the fire-extinguishing stuff that firefighters use also has a potent smell.
Later in the week, more about the investigation was revealed, including the fact that cadaver dogs did reportedly sniff out a body in the basement. The case remains a bit befuddling, as Wright and Stevie explore here.
I am certainly asking our listeners, and I think everyone's scratching their heads on this, even authorities, is it possible this is a case of having too many cooks in the kitchen? And let me read to you the update from the Kansas City Star. The Kansas City, Missouri Fire Department. Follow me here because there's going to involve a couple of agencies here. The KCFD says its cadaver dog alerted of a body 1 week before family members found the suspected highway shooter dead.
That sounds very significant.
As fire crews and investigators responded to a house fire in Independence, Missouri, June 16th, where police were searching for a suspected gunman on the run, Kansas City Fire Department was called out as mutual aid. This happens all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And officials say from Kansas City, a cadaver dog alerted them to possible human remains in the flooded basement of the home. And quote, this information was shared with lead investigators before they left the scene. The dog's alert was most likely for the body of Oscar Sanchez Munoz of Independence, whom police were searching for in connection to a series of highway shootings earlier that night that killed one and injured four. Law enforcement did not find Sanchez Munoz's body that night and, in fact, launched a week-long manhunt that came up until Wednesday when family members reported they found a body in the same flooded basement police had already searched. The revelation appears to be a remarkable disconnect between responding agencies and a failure to follow up on, this says an important lead, I would call it the lead, to finding a person considered to be armed and dangerous. Hopkins says KCFD was asked to assist Independence, as well as local police, in responding to the house fire on that day, June 16th. Fire department deployed its cadaver dog to help search. The dog alerted the handler to the basement of the home. However, fire crews could not go in any further. Quote, due to the significant amount of debris and standing water in the basement from the firefighters' water, a physical search at that time did not result in locating any human remains. So basically they were saying, dog finds body, says there's something down there. They pass that on to investigators, and FIRE says, look, we could not get down there, nor would we, because of the significant amount of debris in the standing water. They were there for about 30 minutes, FIRE was. Hopkins says, though, before sharing the information with the lead agencies, they got the alert, told everybody there, and left.
Smart.
He said KCFD did not follow up on the alert over the next week, quote, because the department was no longer involved in the case. He said he could not speak to why it took another week to find the body and directed further questions back to the other responding agencies. So FIRE is saying, look, we did what we were asked to do. We showed up. We assisted. Cadaver dog alerted.
Yep.
We passed that on to, quote, all of the lead investigators, and we left. It begs so many questions that over the course of the next week, went on every news station, on the front page of the Kansas City Star, on this program, they released an updated photo of the suspect yesterday, and I said he looked like the failed member of a Justin Bieber tribute band. We were all looking for this guy. Why? Question number one, did no one at FIRE, despite the fact they were no longer involved in the case, pick up the phone and go, I'm sorry.
Have you checked the basement?
Did anyone go back and check the basement? Because maybe there was something lost in translation here. But when we were there, we told y'all that the cadaver dog said, hey, there's something going on down here in the debris-filled basement. Yes, Kansas City FIRE is right in saying we're no longer involved with the case. We showed up, did our job, got out of there, told the people that needed to know, we're done. It does beg the question, because there are friends within departments. There are friends of FIRE and police. Like, it's like radio. Like, I could pick up the phone and call someone else at another radio station and be like, hey, not my, like, business here, because we're out. But did you know, like, dot, dot, dot? Like,
right.
Why did that not happen? And right. I know it's not on FIRE. FIRE did their job.
And if multiple different agencies were involved in the initial investigation, would they not have some sort of follow-up while the active manhunt is still an active manhunt?
This is what it says, quote, all officials on scene were made aware that the dog had alerted to the basement. All officials on scene. What actions or searches were conducted after FIRE's departure, I cannot speak to, end quote.
Now, let's change the scenario here for a second. Let's say that this were a run-of-the-mill house fire. Weird things happen all the time in house fires. It could have been a situation where an individual is downstairs in their basement doing laundry, and the fire started in their kitchen right at the top of the basement stairs, right? The fire department comes, they put out that fire, and for whatever reason, because there's clutter and water in the basement,
which as there would be,
they don't go down to clear the basement. Say there's some individual down there in neck-deep water that is barely surviving. Water, by the way, that filled up because the fire department came to put out the fire that was burning down their house. And then that individual dies.
Do you not search? Sam, I don't...
How do you not go down? Water and debris is not an excuse to not go down and search the basement.
Well, or if it was 10 foot of water, which I do not believe that it was, let's be clear.
Well, 10 foot of water would have been water out of the basement.
You would bring in Lee's Summit. Dive.
Right.
You would bring in the dive team. I don't think that's what the case was here. Do I think it was a hoarded mess down there? And then on top of that, you probably had a floor collapse. So you have debris pancaking down the way we see during fires. The difference in this scenario, you guys, clearly, is that there was believed to be a very, very dangerous person willy-nilly firing at people on the highway, killing one during one of the largest events that our city has ever seen or might ever see in the future.
Which makes searching that basement that much more
critical because he was such a dangerous man. Now, today, officials, you would not want to be a spokesperson for Independence today, my God. Officials for the Independence Fire Department, which led the fire response, did not immediately respond to a request for comment from the Kansas City Star. The Independence Police Department did not immediately respond to questions about whether or not they were informed of a dog alerting to human remains. I'm going to tell you this, and correct us if we're wrong, if you're law enforcement on the text line. If Kansas City is called in for mutual aid, the lead at that scene in Independence should have been Independence. The house was in Independence. The initial response was in Independence. Now, Kansas City was actively involved, as was KCK, in looking for this dangerous individual. But at the scene of that fire, Independence is in charge of that scene.
The only thing that I could think of that would change that is if they chased him there in any way. I don't remember if there was a police chase involved in this whole situation.
They knew he was there, right? Yeah. They thought he was there.
Well, they definitely, I mean, somehow keyed on that house. I don't know if they were chasing him and that's how they found him there. And in that scenario, if they were the ones that initiated the chase went into Independence, would they maintain authority over that scene? It seems to me like KCPD has authority over that scene because they're the ones answering all the questions. We're not asking IPD anything.
I know. And KCPD, you know, they're saying today, this was not on us.
Of course.
They're saying, quote, this home was very thoroughly searched.
Clearly not.
I can completely understand that it raises the question, how could this happen? He repeatedly said the basement of the home was cluttered with debris and initially flooded. And Bikina even said that, you know, there are some things they need to iron out between agencies. But he said something to the effect of this was one of the most cluttered homes on that lower level he has ever encountered. One of the most cluttered. Okay, I'm not saying it wasn't. I'm sure that thing was a nightmare and a mess. Right. But now that we know that someone with KC Fire said, look, the dog handler says there's remains down there, or they are hitting on possible human remains down there. Who?
With regard to the clutter, if you get a call for a welfare check on an elderly woman who lives in an apartment that's hoarded, you don't get to open the front door of that apartment and say, there's stuff in here.
I think now it's beyond
Darn
that.
It.
Forget about the clutter. Forget about whether or not this was the most immaculate house you've ever stepped into or clutter. At the point that someone with KC Fire says the dog is alerting to remains, number one, how was that not received with the multiple agencies on scene where KCFD is saying, we told everybody.
Which there should be paperwork indicating that that communication was passed on.
And then dot, 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 you know, like in the next week, did someone not think we should pick up the phone and remind them that there was a dog that's, the whole thing is just, it is mind-boggling.
And not to be grotesque with this detail, but the family knew that he was down there because it had been 8 days of hot, humid, muggy weather and
the family,
bodies do a certain thing in hot and humid and muggy weather.
Well, I'm just going to say it. The family showed up to try to put their house back together, if that's even possible, salvage what they can from their burned out home. And they knew immediately. They smelled death, then called authorities. Authorities come out and say, oh, look, we found a body. And then fire says, yeah, we told you that a week ago. That's
back to your question.
That is the wrap up.
About too many cooks in the kitchen, though. Is there a chance that there was a, no, this is our scene?
No, I don't think so. Not with something like this. Not with something like this, because you know what? I don't think Independence has dogs. If they had cadaver searching dogs, why call Kansas City Fire out?
That's a great question.
The Dana and Parks Show also discussed a cold case murder recently solved in Las Vegas and how it shows the new ways DNA evidence is being used to solve crimes. Daniel Ziesler was found murdered in 2005. Though authorities believe they've found his murderer, the suspect has not been publicly named, and they reportedly died years ago.
Update on a story out of Las Vegas, and the end result of the story ticks me off. We'll get to that in a minute. From CBS News, authorities have finally solved the murder of a Las Vegas man who was strangled to death with a telephone cord inside of his home more than 20 years ago. And you can guess how they did it.
They traced his bad debt?
They traced his bad DNA. The case dates back to December 29th, 2005, when an apartment manager reported something was amiss at a property in Las Vegas. Police get there. They determined the victim had died from strangulation with a phone cord, and his car was missing, along with his keys to his home. They found the car abandoned, and then everything went cold, right? They recovered a DNA profile that they all thought this entire time was linked to the person responsible. However, they never got a match because the person responsible was not in the system as a violent offender at that time. So fast forward to 2024, investigators resubmit the DNA profile for lab analysis, and they used the genealogy route. They were able to trace that sample to a relative of the suspect in this man's murder, who detectives also believe was seen in surveillance footage shortly after the killing, having used this man's car to drive to a store and his bank card to make a purchase there. So long story short, it was always the guy that they thought it was. It took all of this time until we have the genealogical testing.
They just didn't have any concrete evidence
to actually say, yes, this is the guy who did it. The potential murder suspect, who was not publicly named, and this is where I get ticked off, died in 2020.
Mm.
Though an arrest is not possible, the lab still characterizes the person's identification as a significant breakthrough in the case. Number one, why the hell would you not release the identity of the homicidal maniac that strangled someone in Vegas with a telephone cord? And number two, because we didn't have this specific technology until the last, what, 5 years that police departments started using this, I always ask you this. How many other people did that person kill in all of the 20 or 30 years he was out roaming around amongst us that they weren't able to bring him to justice? That's what makes me mad about this. I just think we have the technology now with the DNA databases. I don't understand why we're not using it all the time, not just for justice for the victims and the families, to protect the rest of us from all of the weirdos that are still out there free because it's an unknown killer.
Well, and I think the biggest problem is the fact that legal defense and legal defense knows straight up that they can pick that argument apart pretty quickly.
No, I think it's funding. They don't have the funding to test all of the samples. That's absolutely what it is. We talked to a police department about this a few months ago, and I'm trying to remember the cost, but Sam, it was astronomical. They raised some money through the family. They used some federal grant money. They cobbled together some money from one of the city's budget. I want to say it was Overland Park. And they were finally able to make it happen. But they said the days of, like, when you watch 48 hours and you think they're just going to shove it into some genealogical database, these are private companies, and it is very, very costly to test.
The lab testing can top $1,500 per sample. But what I was talking about was that most of the cases here, typically it's like a 15% match, a 30% match, a 60% match.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact that if they're not confident, if they don't have good other hard evidence, which it seems like they had other hard evidence pointing to this guy.
Yeah, you have to have. You can't just have the DNA.
Then it doesn't matter if we have some slight comparison to some ancestry database where, you know, his fourth cousin did ancestry 6 years ago.
Yes, but any good detective will tell you what you do is you look at that tree and immediately you know the killer was male. It's male DNA. So you wipe out all the women in the tree. It's not a woman.
Yeah.
Then you wipe out all of the dead people in the tree. Yeah. It's not the dead people. And you just keep going. Then you go, all right, which one of these bozos happened to live in Las Vegas at the time this guy was killed? All right, now we've narrowed it down, what, to two, three, maybe one? So the other detective work has to come along with it. I just think the cost it's so cost prohibitive. They've got to figure out a way to make that.
It's not going
to
go down.
More cost effective to solve more cases to protect the rest of us.
An ongoing cold case that captured the public's attention earlier this year was the disappearance of Today Show host Savannah Guthrie's mother, Nancy, near Tucson, Arizona. It's now been around 5 months since the octogenarian went missing, and a new detail about one of the multiple ransom notes sent in regarding the case was revealed this week. ABC News' Peter Haralambos joined Odyssey station KCBS Radio in San Francisco to discuss this dark discovery.
This is an update that many have been dreading, but in many ways feels inevitable. After nearly 5 months, ABC News can now report that a second ransom note received by a local television station following the disappearance of Nancy Guthrie said she died shortly after her abduction and was buried in nature. This note came just days after an initial note that requested millions of dollars in cryptocurrency in exchange for her return. Savannah Guthrie seemingly referenced this on a February 7th Instagram post when she said, and I quote, "We received your message and we understand. We beg you now to return our mother to us so we can celebrate with her. This is the only way we can have peace."
Do investigators think this note is legit? And does the Guthrie family think it's legit?
So the Guthrie family, and Savannah Guthrie has said this in previous interviews, says that she believes that those notes were likely real and authentic. Though law enforcement has always had their doubts, that's the reason why they've held this information, we understand, for so long. They've been working to authenticate these two notes and also to be able to work back those communications to whoever sent them. So, you know, they've always taken these notes with a grain of salt, but where the story is at the moment, the fact that it's been so many months, the fact that Nancy Guthrie relied on certain medications given her older age, all suggest at this point that these notes in all likelihood were authentic and that Nancy Guthrie at this point is, as the note says, buried in nature.
Peter, there have been so many scammers and fakes who came out of the woodwork with tips and notes really not unlike this one. What is it about this one that stands out that has investigators and the Guthrie family believing it is in fact legitimate?
Yeah, it's a great question, because we saw this kind of onslaught of what appeared to be phony messages in the days after the disappearance, and as public attention kind of heightened here, there were a few references in these notes. The references, for example, to asking certain information about things, where things were located in her home, kind of a method to kind of authenticate this information, knowing that, you know, if they can confirm that, it would be authentic. Now, on top of that, the timing of these, the fact that these were kind of the initial notes sent to a local television station, all of that suggests that it might in fact be true, it might be accurate. Ultimately, though, they've still been unable to truly say with certainty these were legitimate, and certainly they've been unable to work them backwards to figure out who exactly sent them. At this point, the investigation is still ongoing. We see that there's still $1 million reward for anyone who has information, and both the FBI and the Pima County Sheriff's Office are still accepting tips if anyone has information about who might have done this.
Peter, in our last 30 seconds or so, through your investigation of this case, do we know, was Nancy Guthrie targeted? Was it a random kidnapping? What happened here?
Yeah, I mean, that's the big question that kind of remains unknown. She wasn't necessarily a public figure in the same way that her daughter is, but certainly this was a wealthy community. This possibly was an opportunity scene for a payday. It could have also been the fact that the house they believed might have been empty at the time. It's really, unfortunately, impossible to say what led to this, why they decided she would be the person to target, and what really led to this very tragic outcome.
Haralambos also joined the show A New Morning out of Odyssey station WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo, New York, to further discuss the Guthrie case.
And there was a report that we had a few weeks ago that said she was buried in Mexico. Where are investigators looking? Are they currently looking for some type of a grave in nature?
Yeah, there was a period of time where they renewed their search, looking kind of in the desert, basically, to see if they could find any remnants. But ultimately, this investigation has kind of focused now more on finding potentially the people responsible for this. There's still $1 million reward for anyone who might have information about this disappearance and who was responsible for it. Though it does not appear they're actively going out into the desert and searching, given the kind of wide range of places, millions of acres, where she could have been potentially buried.
And to be clear, this note, this information is new, but the note itself is not. Have we had any new information or new evidence within the last few weeks?
Not particularly. And you're right, this note was received on February 7th. You know, we're talking about 5 months ago at this point. And since then, the investigation has cooled, though I will note there has been a lot of finger pointing. There's been a lot of people, basically, particularly the FBI and the sheriff's office, blaming each other for why this investigation was unsuccessful. So the FBI said, the FBI Director Kash Patel claimed that his agents were uninvolved in this and that they were blocked from participating. The sheriff's office had said that's just categorically false and that FBI agents were helping from the very start. There's also been an effort to remove the sheriff for allegedly kind of failing in this investigation. That was ultimately unsuccessful by the Board of Commissioners, but certainly a lot of scrutiny on the sheriff's office, on the FBI, given how much resources and time and energy was poured into this with no successful outcome.
Any idea how much has been spent on this investigation? And remind us, who's leading it? Is it the FBI or is it the sheriff?
That's a great question. I don't think anyone knows who technically is in charge, but it appears the final calls are being made by the sheriff's office, in that they were the ones who make decisions about, for example, the DNA evidence and where it would be sent. The FBI, if anything, has been taking a leading role on the federal side of things, offering their resources, sending in hundreds of agents back in February. The FBI at the time had vowed to devote all their resources possible to this. The price tag, though, remains to be seen. I think we'll figure that out in the coming months and years as there are public disclosures about how many resources were expended into this. It's likely, though, in the millions or tens of millions at this point.
Crime and terrorism analyst Brad Garrett weighed in on the Guthrie case in an interview with A New Morning as well.
What do we know about this so far, and how do we go about, you know, figuring out if any of these are legitimate or not?
So let's start with that we don't have the whole note that's being referred to here. We have a couple of statements out of it. One that you mentioned, that Nancy died, I think they used the word unintentionally, which has a number of definitions. I mean, unintentionally means we didn't mean to kill her, or she died because of a medical issue or whatever it might be. Obviously, the circumstances, I'm going to presume, of how she was abducted, that alone could have possibly caused her to die. So you start with that. And then the note makes a comment about she's now with nature, which I'm going to assume means that she's buried someplace or laid to rest. And then there's no ransom demand. There's nothing else. There's also no information about where the family might find Nancy. And it's just left at that. And I think that note came in a week or two after Nancy disappeared. But law enforcement just now released part of it, because they can't do anything else with it as far as identifying who wrote the note.
Brad, has this case ever made any sense to you, especially for a motive?
Well, because this is what I do, is analyze cases every day, is that you always have to be careful because you just don't know the mind of the abductor in this case. Now, if you want to assume, and maybe rightly so, that the guy at the front door that spends that inordinate amount of time wandering around at the front door with that odd mask and a weapon in the middle of his, in the front of his pants, which is where no one carries a weapon, and spends way too much time out there. And then, again, according to law enforcement, spends 40 plus minutes in the house. I mean, who in the world does that unless somebody that they don't know what they're doing, or there's some sort of other issue with them, that you have that. So the reason I'm saying that, Susan, is that, what was his motive here? Was it ever money? Is this personal? What is it? Because he clearly doesn't ask for money, or at least they haven't released that in this note. But he also hasn't commented about where the family could maybe find her. So you have all of that. And so coming up with what's the real motive in this case, in my view, could be either way. It could be a financial, personal, or it could be a combination of both.
Well, I mean, at this point, it's almost as if, I don't know, none of this matters. I mean, there certainly it doesn't seem like anybody's going to be paying any sort of ransom at this point in time. And I don't know these people who are responsible. It's almost as if they appear to be getting away scot-free. I mean, there seems to be no credible leads.
Well, but that's not law enforcement's fault. I mean, as long as law enforcement works thoroughly every physical lead and every laboratory/forensic lead, and they've come up with nothing, then it's really at the mercy of the public to help them solve this. And, you know, the advantage of releasing things like at least part of this note may generate some new leads, because this is a case, like many cases, that one phone call, you can solve it. Now, but it has to be the right phone call, obviously. So we'll see. I mean, we're, what, 3+ months into this case, and it doesn't appear like it's going to be solved anytime soon, but we don't really know. There could be a call later today that could take them to it, or that we will have this conversation 6 months from now.
But why all of the attention now on this second ransom note?
Well, I think the attention being obviously the two things that we've talked about this morning, maybe add to some mindset of the abductor. And it may be something that does help law enforcement solve this case again, because it may generate new leads. So I think in this case, obviously, has a tremendous media appeal to it. And anything that comes out remotely new, people want to hear about it. Because let's face it, the idea that an elderly parent that gets kidnapped this way, we all can have empathy with that. And I think so this case touches a lot of people.
Well, I mean, now we're just kind of looking at back in retrospect. This note had been out for some time right now. We go back to that question of legitimacy. I mean, for so much, all the attention this has gotten, a lot of people seem to be kind of assuming that the notes are legitimate. And we don't really have much of an idea that that's really the case.
Yeah, totally. I mean, could this just be somebody that wanted to inject themselves into the case? Sure, that is a possibility. But we don't know what law enforcement's thoughts are. I'm going to, again, assume that it has some level of legitimacy with law enforcement, or they wouldn't have waited this long to release it to the public. But clearly, I don't know the answer to that. So we'll see.
Thank you so much for listening to this True Crime Roundup from the On Deadline podcast. This episode was written and produced by me, Lauren Berry. Special thanks to 1010 Winds in New York, KYW News Radio in Philadelphia, WBBM News Radio in Chicago, WCCO News Talk in the Twin Cities, KNX News in Los Angeles, The Dana and Parks Show out of KMBZ in Kansas City, KCBS Radio in San Francisco, and A New Morning out of WBEN News and Talk in Buffalo. You can find these programs on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts. You can find these true crime roundups by subscribing to the On Deadline podcast, the Who Killed Strawberry podcast, or the Bitter Academia podcast on the Odyssey app or wherever you find your podcasts.
Every week on the Moth Podcast, you'll hear true stories that will intrigue you, inspire you, and make you laugh.
She said, "Is there anything in your diet that might be spiking your blood sugar?" I said, "Sometimes I eat pizza until I'm unconscious." He said, "I think that might be it."
For real stories live on stage from comedians, astronauts, accountants, farmers, and people just like you, follow and listen to The Moth wherever you get your podcasts.